Okay, so we were talking about alcohol oxidation when we were stopped by the bell last time in section 16.14. And I want to talk about the problem of stopping at the aldehyde. So here you see you start with an alcohol. We spoke about the mechanism. You remember, you bring an atom on, it shares an electron pair, then it leaves with the electron pair. So it has the, it shares an electron pair from the material it's approaching. So it takes away a pair of electrons. And in doing that, it converts primary alcohol to an aldehyde. But if there's water around, as there is in this reagent, then the water can add to the aldehyde. Remember, that's a favorable equilibrium to form the hydrate. And now the hydrate is itself an alcohol. So if there's a hydrogen on the carbon next to the alcohol, then you can do the same trick again. Put a leaving group on here that comes up, takes the electrons and leaves with it, and a proton is lost to generate the double bond. So it can be hard to stop at the aldehyde. It can go on and react to give the carboxylic acid. Now there's some tricks for enabling you to stop at the aldehyde. One is there are some reagents that can be used sometimes that stop at an aldehyde. For example, MnO2 in this case stops at an aldehyde. But you see that nitric acid goes all the way to the carboxylic acid. Of course, it's not a problem if there's only one hydrogen on the carbon, then there's only one elimination possible, right? And you can only generate a ketone. You can't go on and oxidize that further, at least not in any simple way. Here's a case where DMSO and oxalyl chloride stops at an aldehyde. But I want to mention one other that's fairly obvious when you think about it. There's this reagent called pyridinium chlorochromate, which is where the chromium 6 is in the form of one chlorine attached to the chromine and O minus, and then two double bonds to oxygen. So it's the same kind that we talked at the end last time about a number of different forms of chromium 6, and they all do the same thing. The O attacks the chromium, sharing its electron pair. The chromium takes off with the electron pair, leaving the O positive, and an adjacent proton leaves to generate the double bond. So here's an example from Loudon's textbook that we used last year of pyridinium chlorochromate. So the cation is pyridinium, this nitrogen in a benzene ring that's been protonated, so it's pyridinium cation, and then the chlorine is attached to CrO3 to give that anion that I showed before. But the interesting thing about this is that this oxidizing agent, unlike chromic acid, is soluble in methylene chloride. Can you see why that might be an advantage, given what we're trying to do? Eric?
There's no water.
No water means you can't form the hydrate of the aldehyde, and that means you don't have an alcohol that provides the mechanism for carrying on to the second stage of oxidation. Remember, the general idea is you start with a primary alcohol, you oxidize it, you get an aldehyde, right? Now, that would be the end of the line as far as the mechanism goes, except that the aldehyde can add water, and now it's an alcohol again. Now you can do the same reaction again. No water, as it says here, no water, no diol, no over-oxidation. So that's an obvious approach to stopping at the aldehyde. And see, in this case, they get 92% yield. However, if you look in Wikipedia about pyridinium chlorochromate, it gives a caution that's not given in Loudon's textbook. It says, in practice, the chromium byproduct deposits with pyridine as a sticky black tar, which can complicate matters. Have your experiments in lab been so carefully chosen that you never get sticky black tars? I suspect that's so. But what you find when you do real things, it's not uncommon to encounter sticky black tars. Is this right, John?
Oh, yeah.
Okay, so a lot of reagents that are cracked up to be really great, maybe they are great, but you have to be careful about how you separate things and so on. So you should read some of these, you know, you're given things to do problems with in a course like this. Oh, you do this reaction, then this reaction, then this reaction, then this reaction. You got the product, but they don't tell you about all the stuff you had to do in between, like this sticky black tar. Okay, then I was going to mention just in passing this vicinal diol cleavage here. Now, periodic acid has IO double bonds. So not too surprising, if you have a diol, you can form an acetal. Right? Here's the... this is just like a ketone, as if the iodine were a carbon and a ketone, then the diols could form an acetal. But now this acetal is set up so that if you follow the curved arrows, the important curved arrow is the one that's just above my finger here, which breaks the carbon-carbon bond. Right? So then it generates a CO double bond O, a CO double bond here, a CO double bond here, and iodine takes off in a lower oxidation level than it was before. What was the oxidation level of iodine here, assuming that iodine is as true as less electronegative than oxygen? So what was its oxidation level of iodine here?
Seven.
It's 7. And what is it here? 5. Right, so it's 5 bonds to oxygen. So iodine got reduced, and the diol got oxidized in a sort of unusual way, making 2 carbonyls and breaking the C-C bond. So the carbons, which here were -1, assuming the R's to be carbons, here they're -1, here they're -2. Okay, yeah. Say again, please. That's because water was lost in forming the acetal. 2 H's went away too. Remember, 2 alcohols and a ketone lose water and make an acetal. So that's where the other oxygen went. Does that answer it? Okay, so that's diol cleavage, which turned out to be important in the chemistry of sugars, because you remember sugars are long carbon chains that have oxygens all along, so it's possible to break those things apart, and that was important in proving the structure of sugars, which I hope to have one lecture on toward the end of the course here. So this is just to remind you of what Professor Siegel mentioned, that it's good practice to look at how you would go from one of these things to another. When you go, so from, you can have alkenes, alkyl halides, alcohols, and amines. These things can have the same oxidation level, so you don't need an oxidizing or reducing agent to go to them. And you can think about, as we go along, what reagents can be used to go among these. Or if you go along this way, then you have to have oxidizing agents, or going to the left, reducing agents. So it's a good drill to try to see how many of those reagents you can fill in. It's a nice way to organize your study. Okay, now, alcohol synthesis is in sections 1613 and 1615, and often when you talk about synthesis, in designing a synthesis, you know what you want to get, and the problem is to go backwards to figure out what you could use to get it. That's called retrosynthesis. And in particular, hydride reduction is something we'll talk a little bit about another aspect of that, but it's page 802. So here are alcohol, this is page 800, but you see here are alcohol synthesis, like use a Grignard reagent, so an R minus, in effect, adds to a carbonyl to give this, which then can, it's an O minus, put a proton on it, and you have a primary alcohol. Or if you, that's with formaldehyde, primary alcohol. An aldehyde gives a secondary alcohol, 2 R groups. A ketone, which isn't shown here but is later, will give a tertiary alcohol, and it gives some examples here. But the particular thing I wanted to show was over here, where the nucleophile that comes on page 802 is not a carbon to form that kind of alcohol, but a hydride, like lithium aluminum hydride or sodium borohydride, these H minus reagents, where H is the nucleophile that adds, and then from formaldehyde you get methanol. From an aldehyde that has an R group on it, you get a primary alcohol. So you could either add a carbon on the previous slide or hydrogen, hydride or carbon anion. Okay, so that's hydride reduction. Now, a little bit about when you add a carbon nucleophile, there's a problem 1624 in the book, which is instructive. So let's work through it together and you can help me solve it. So it says, starting from alcohols containing no more than three carbon atoms and inorganic reagents of your choice, devise syntheses for the following molecules. Now, you'd almost never do this for the simpler ones. You might have to make the more complicated ones here. But the other ones you'd buy, it'd be cheaper than the stuff that you'd buy to make it. But anyhow, let's say here. How about, what's the problem in making this alcohol? You can start from an alcohol. Can you just start with this one, Brian? It's got four carbons, so we're going to have to break it. We're going to have to put it together in pieces. So we can think backwards about which bond we would break, which pieces we would bring together. So one possibility would be to make that bond. So one of these carbons then will have to attack the other carbon. One of them probably is a high HOMO, the other is a low LUMO. Okay? Now, here we could get a low LUMO on this pair of carbons by having an epoxide. Okay? And we know that strained ring can be opened, and if you attack with an anion here and attack this bond will break, you'll get O minus, protonate it, you've got an alcohol. So the question is then, what are we going to use for a high HOMO? How will we get a carbon that's a high HOMO to affect this reaction? Right, a Grignard reagent, as we call it. Good. Okay, so that's the reaction we want to do. And what's happening here? There we go. So we need a nucleophilic carbon, but we have to start with an alcohol. Okay? Now, what we want to get is RMGBR, say. That's the Grignard reagent. Now, we have somehow to work backwards from that to get an alcohol. What do you make Grignard reagents from? We talked about this last time. Do you remember? Don? You need a halide. So we're going to have a halide to do that. First, we're going to have the magnesium to react with the halide, so we need the halide. Where are we going to get the halide? We have to start with alcohols. Derek? No, Friedel-Crafts requires the halide. That's the starting material for a Friedel-Crafts reaction. But where do you get the halide from is the question, yeah. You could add HBr to an alkene. Right? That would be possible. You'd have to have ethylene. But now you have the problem of getting ethylene. Kathy, you got an idea? We have to start with an alcohol and get ethyl bromide. The R we want here is two carbons, ethyl. Ethyl bromide. Mike?
Can you protonate the alcohol and attack with halogen?
Can you do which?
Protonate the alcohol to make the water as an anion group and attack with halogen?
That's a possibility. But and in fact, you can, in a simple case like this, you can do it. But there's a reagent that gives you a much, much more downhill. It's easy to do it. You make the OH into a leaving group, which is what you're doing by H+. But there's another reagent if I had you solve a lot of problems, every one of you would know this right away. So maybe I should have you solve a lot of problems. I don't know. But there's a reagent we talked about when we were talking about nucleophilic substitution reactions that converts alcohols to bromides.
SOCl2.
SOCl2 is the one that gives a chloride. But what's the analog for giving bromide? You might say SOBR2, but that's not readily available. It's PBR3. And we talked about this at the time. Okay, so you can start with the alcohol, PBR3. So here's a 2-carbon alcohol. Now we have to get this somehow from an alcohol, 2-carbon alcohol, presumably. So what do you make epoxides from? How do you put that oxide? How do you make that 3-member drink? Anybody remember? Victor? Can't hear. No, ozonolysis converts a carbon-carbon double bond into 2 ketones. Okay.
Do you attack an alkene with a peroxycarboxylic acid?
A peroxycarboxylic acid, right? So we could get that from a peroxycarboxylic acid from an alkene, but we'd have to get the alkene. Where do you get an alkene from? If you have an alcohol. Dehydrate it, right? Treat it with acid and so on. Okay, but it takes 3 steps for methanol to get down here, right? So that's not so efficient. This is a possibility, but it's not such an efficient way to do it. Okay, I mean, in practice, it would be an efficient way to do it because you could buy ethylene oxide, right? But for purposes of a game like this, which is this is like a crossword puzzle, right? Professor Ziegler, who's a synthetic chemist in the department, loves to do the Times crossword puzzle. It's a similar kind of thing to do. So given the constraints of your problem, then that would have been an inefficient way to do it, right? So what's another way to do it is to make a different bond, right? We still can have, now we can have 3 carbons and 1 carbon. Now, what would the 3-carbon bit be? What we want to do is, well, what about the 1-carbon? How are we going to attack 1-carbon and be left with an alcohol? What's the form of that carbon going to be beginning with that we can attack with something else, and after attacking it, we have an alcohol? Huh? Formaldehyde, right? We just talked about that. So if we had CH2O up there, then all we need is a nucleophilic carbon here to attack, go up, and we've got our alcohol. Where are we going to get a nucleophilic carbon here? It's exactly this, right? Except we start with a 3-carbon alcohol, make the bromide, the magnesium, the Grignard reagent, and we got it. So this is what we're showing here is versatility of the Grignard reagent, that you can make lots of different alcohols from it. Okay, so that solves that, and it's only 1 step from methanol to get formaldehyde. I mean, in fact, you would buy it. You would make it, but it is, with the constraints of the problem, you could make it in just 1 step rather than 3 steps for that other way we did. Okay, so much for that. Now, how about question B? Okay, well, we could make that bond analogously to what we did here, but so the 3-carbon bit we just talked about to get here, the Grignard, what do we need to be attacked? We need that aldehyde. Everybody with me? Okay, now, where in the world are we going to get that aldehyde? Because it has 4 carbons in it. We can only use 3. Any ideas on where we might get that aldehyde? Henry? It's what we just got. Right? Okay, so now we do 1 more step. Or actually, we have to oxidize that alcohol to the aldehyde, which is what we were just talking about with pyridinium chlorochromate, and then you have to deal with this black tar and stuff, or maybe MnO2 or something. I don't know. Anyhow, you oxidize that alcohol to get the aldehyde, and then you've got your reaction. So we got that one. Now, how about the next one? How about C? What bond are you going to make there? Right, make that bond, except we start with isopropyl alcohol instead of n-propyl alcohol. Okay, so we got that one. Now, how about this one? Brian?
Start with B and oxidize.
Start with B and oxidize it to make that a ketone, and then make this bond. Okay, because we got the ketone already, or we, all practically all we have to do is oxidize. Easy to oxidize to a ketone, harder to stop at the aldehyde, but we've seen a way to stop at the aldehyde using PCC, this pyridinium chlorochromate, no water. Okay, so we got that one. Now, how about the next one? E. Well, we could make that bond. For example, we've already talked about making a bond from isopropyl here. Okay, but we'd need this ketone. Where are we going to get that ketone? It's that, just bent around in a different shape. Okay, so that would be easy. But there are more than one way to skin a cat here. What's another idea, Nancy? You could start with C and oxidize it to a ketone, and then you'd make that bond. Okay. Now, and then finally, when we go over here, there are three different R groups. So you could imagine three different ways to approach. In fact, if you could go back and start when we first added the formaldehyde, we could put any one of these on first, and then any one of them on second, and then any one of them on third. So is there any preferred order to do this, or we can just do whatever we feel like? This brings us to another look at the versatility of Grignard reagents. Sometimes the versatility isn't so handy. Here, this one works fine. That's what we've just been talking about, and gives that compound in as a salt, of course, originally. Right, but then you treat it with acid and water and protonate the O minus, so you've got the alcohol. That's fine. And it's 95% yield. You can't complain about that. Okay, now, how about trying it with T-butyl magnesium bromide to put a T-butyl group on here? Looks like just the same thing again. Can you see any problems? Maybe? Sure? It's going to be pretty crowded. And let's see what happens. What we want to get is this, right? In fact, the yield of that is 0%. Okay? Now, it is possible to make more hindered ketones sometimes, more hindered alcohols, by using a lithium instead of a magnesium bromide. That sometimes helps. But in this case, the product you get is 65% of adding what? What did we add? What was the nucleophile? Hydride, not the carbon anion, but H anion. Where in the world did that come from? It's reduction by H minus. Okay? But this is the reagent you added. Right before you had this. So there, where are the hydrogen coming from? Okay, so there's the T-butyl magnesium bromide. Can anybody see where the hydride might come from? That beta hydrogen, adjacent to the carbon anion, or the thing that's behaving like a carbon anion. Right? So it's possible in this case to the high HOMO here helps forms a double bond, and hydride can leave an attack. So it's not nearly as crowded to get this hydrogen near that carbon as it would be to get that carbon near the other carbon. So because it's sterically hindered, it loses this beta hydride, and at the same time, of course, this comes over and makes the salt. Right, and then when we add the H plus, we take the O minus of the salt, gets a proton on it, and we get this product in 65% yield. What's the other product? What happened to the T-butyl group? Yeah.
It has a double bond now.
Right, it has a double bond. Right? It's isobutylene. And in fact, you've seen this very kind of thing before where you have steric hindrance, which is if you have two T-butyl radicals, instead of coming together to form a carbon-carbon bond, they tend to transfer a hydrogen from one to the other. In this case, a hydrogen atom, because you're dealing with radicals. In this case, it's the hydride ion. But anyhow, one T-butyl gets the H, the other T-butyl loses the H and becomes that. So you've seen exactly the same kind of process before. Okay, so that's not so good. Now, maybe we could do that kind of thing if we didn't have, and this is to avoid steric hindrance, as I said, if we have neopentyl, so now it's T-butyl with a CH2 in between. So it's a CH2 anion. But you notice something about that. It doesn't have any beta hydrogens, because the carbon next to this carbon doesn't have any hydrogens. It has methyl groups on it in the T-butyl group. So it's not going to be able to do this. Okay, so now at least maybe we can do such a reaction. And we get a 4% yield. Okay? Not so great. Yeah.
What does beta hydrogen mean again?
Beta hydrogen. This is called the alpha position, the one in the anion that's like an anion. This hydrogen is on the next carbon, alpha beta, the Greek alphabet, right? So having a beta hydrogen makes it possible to form that double bond with these electrons coming in. But there is no such thing here, so you can't do that. Okay? But you still don't get this, or at least only 4% yield. Right? What you get is this. This anion gets a proton. Where does that proton come from? Somehow from this molecule, you have to get a proton. There are not a lot of choices. You can get it from a CH3. There are lots of those. Or you could get it from the CH. Is statistics going to win and you'll take it from the CH3? What do you say, Shirley? Incidentally, a less substituted anion is better than more substituted. So if you're going to lose H+ to put on this C-, it would be better to take it from CH3. From that point of view. But there's another point of view. I label this H, H beta. Why do I call that one beta? What's it adjacent to? That? Right, the carbon-oxygen double bond. This can form an enolate anion, right? Lose that proton and the anion is very stable because it's stabilized by the pi star here. Right, so that's where it comes from. You get the enolate, and then in the second step when you add H+, you put the H+ back on the enolate and get the starting ketone. So nothing happened. The only thing that happened was you destroyed the Grignard reagent that you had carefully prepared here in the first place by putting an H+ on it. Right? Okay, and that's 90% yield. And in fact, notice this was only 65% yield here. The other 35% is the same deal happening here, that this T-butyl can also take H-beta. Okay, so Grignard reagents are very, very, very powerful and useful. And Victor Grignard well deserved the Nobel Prize he got in 1909 for that. But there are other things that can happen too. There can be complications. Okay. So, if you wanted, this is from the textbook by Roberts and Casario. If you wanted to make this alcohol, when you put a proton on, MgX comes off, you get that alcohol. There would be several ways of doing it. One way would be to use this Grignard reagent and add it to acetone. But another way would be to add the methyl Grignard. And there's a big advantage of using a methyl Grignard over this one, because this one has a beta hydrogen, and methyl doesn't have a beta hydrogen. Right? So that's got a beta hydrogen and steric hindrance. Right? So there's a risk of reduction, the thing we saw in the previous slide. So you would prefer this one over this one. Okay, now the Wittig reagent is 1617, the Wittig reaction, and that's an interesting one, which is shown here. So it involves this interesting reagent, triphenylphosphine. And as I say here on the slide, triphenylphosphine is good at taking up oxygen to form this PO double bond, which is an unusually strong bond. I was trying to find its bond strength and was unable to, but it's very strong. Okay, so, but like nitrogen, it's a nucleophile, so you can do an SN2 reaction and put a carbon on there. Okay, now it's phosphorus cation. But this methyl group is unusual in being acidic. Now, why should it be acidic? Why should it be good to lose a proton from here? Somebody tell me at least one reason. Renji, tell me one reason why it might be. What's the pKa of methane or ethane? Remember, how easy is it to lose a proton? For those that you worry about burning your skin with methane or ethane? Only if it catches fire. Okay, not as an acid. Remember what the pKa is? Anybody else help?
Was it 50?
About 50. Okay, that's not very acidic. But Renji, now you're going to help me. This one is much more acidic. You have an idea why? What makes it easy to lose a proton from this one? One idea. Yeah, there's a positive charge there. So it's much easier to leave a negative charge behind if you leave it near a positive charge. But there's another reason why it's nice to be near phosphorus. Anybody got another idea? Mustafa? Can't hear very well. The phenyl groups aren't so good because they're not conjugated with the C, but the phosphorus itself has an advantage. Phosphorus is below nitrogen on the periodic table. What does that mean it has that nitrogen doesn't have? It's not nearly. If that were nitrogen, then you'd have the positive charge that Renji talked about, and in fact it would be more acidic than normal, but not as acidic as it is when that's phosphorus. What does the phosphorus have, Kevin? It has vacant D orbitals, valent shell orbitals. Okay, so that can help overlap and stabilize the anion. So anyhow, if you treat it with a strong acid, butyl lithium, right? So carbon anion, it takes the proton off and generates this ilid, which you can draw a double bond as a resonance for. You couldn't do that with nitrogen, but you can with phosphorus. And the reason is that the phosphorus has that D orbital that can help stabilize the electrons in the carbon. Okay, and the other product is butane, which just goes up the stack. Okay, so now you got this thing, which is one important resonance structure, has a carbon anion. So this is a little bit like a Grignard reagent, remember, which has a high HOMO on carbon. This has a high HOMO on carbon. So not too surprisingly, it can attack a carbonyl group to give this, right? And now this factor comes into play, that the phosphorus-oxygen bond is so strong, because this phosphorus is right next to the oxygen. Phosphorus plus is right next to the oxygen minus, right? It became minus when you attacked here. So these things form their own bond between phosphorus and oxygen. And now, this thing is so stable that it breaks away. So you get triphenylphosphine oxide, and the thing you're aiming for is this, an alkene. So what happened in this transformation? You started with a ketone here, and you replaced the oxygen by CH2. Suppose you wanted that's obviously a reduction of this carbon, right? The carbon was here, it was plus 2 in its oxidation state. Here it's 0 in its oxidation state. Okay? So this is a reduction of that, but the more important thing is that it changes a CO double bond into a CC double bond. Right? Can you think of any other ways of generating CC double bonds? Caitlin, how can you make a CC double bond, not from the ketone, just from anything, when you don't have it to begin with? There's a simple name for a reaction whose product is a double bond. You start with something that's not a double bond, it's a single bond. And take two things away. You eliminate two things, and now you got a double bond. Elimination reaction. Right, like this. So if you wanted to make this, change this CO double bond into a CC double bond, right? You could do a Grignard or here an alkyl lithium, methyl lithium reaction and get this alcohol, and now do an elimination reaction to generate this. But the problem is you're going to get mostly this stuff, the more substituted double bond. Okay? The nice thing about the Grignard reagent is it specifically changes that CO double bond into the CC double bond because of the mechanism we just saw on the previous page down here. Okay? Yeah.
Is that the Wittig reaction?
That's called the Wittig reaction, yeah. And it was invented by George Wittig. Yeah. And this reagent is the Wittig reagent. This thing here. So this procedure was developed by Wittig. And he got the 1979 Nobel Prize for this because it's very valuable to be able to change a ketone into a CC double bond. Okay, if suppose you wanted to go the other way, you had a CC double bond, and you wanted to cleave it and change it into a ketone. Mayorov, any way to do that? It's obviously going to be an oxidation, right? This was a reduction, so you have to have some oxidizing agent that'll change it into two ketones. Anybody remember that doesn't have the pressure on them? Yeah. Ozone. Right, ozonolysis. Did you say so? Mayorov, I didn't hear you. Got to speak up. Be assertive here on us. Okay, so that's the Wittig reagent. And there are other related reactions that use the phosphorus with anions attached to them that can do the same kind of thing. And here's some examples giving 67% yield, 43% yield. And here it mentions that ozonolysis is reversed. So this is like Professor Siegel's table, right? How do you go this way? How do you go this way? Okay, then I would just remind you that we already talked about this, but there's this section here about biological oxidation, and it shows now in more detail what that NADH molecule is, or NAD plus in this case. And remember, you can do hydride addition at this carbon at the top and change this from a cation into a neutral form. And the reaction is shown down here. And the reason to state it again is to underline that hydride is the thing that comes in and does the nucleophilic aromatic substitution. It's hydride, but it's a beta hydrogen adjacent to the oxygen anion. So this base in the protein takes this proton away, which makes that O minus. Right, the O minus beta to that is the hydride. So just as in the reduction by the Grignard reagent that we saw on the previous slide, where the adjacent anion goes in to make a double bond here, right, displacing the hydride, which is the thing that does the reaction and comes in up here in the nucleophilic aromatic substitution. So these beta hydrogens, beta to a carbonyl, the proton comes off, gives an enolate. Beta to an anion, hydride can come off and do a reduction. Okay, that's all we wanted to say about that. Now, I want to say just something about green chemistry, which is not something I know very much about, but it's topical nowadays, so why don't we say something about it? The reason is that I decided to talk about this is that I was sitting in the chair where Ela is sitting last Tuesday, and there was a guy here from Israel who gave out, I thought was a very interesting talk about devising new catalysts, and I'll mention that when we come to it, probably next lecture. But in his introduction, he talked about this, which I thought was interesting and decided to relate to you. Okay, so pharmaceutical industry is big industry, of course, but it generates less than 0.2% of the chemical industry's mass of product. You know, pills aren't very big, but they're very valuable. It generates 25% of the dollar value with only 0.2% of the mass, which means it's worth doing a lot of manipulations to make this stuff, which of course you have to do. Many drugs have many, many steps to make them. Okay, and that's that's tied into this. It generates more than 50% of chemical waste, even though it's producing only 0.2% of the mass. And one reason, there are several reasons for that, and most of them are rather understandable reasons. One is that to make a pharmaceutical thing that you can sell for a lot of money, it's worth doing many, 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 many steps, and each step is generating some byproducts and waste and so on. So that's reasonable enough. Okay. So, but people are interested in eliminating this waste. And there's a journal called Green Chemistry. In fact, one of the editors of it is in the department here. And in 2007, there was an interesting paper that this guy who gave the talk last week mentioned, so I looked it up. The title is Key Green Chemistry Research Areas, a perspective from pharmaceutical manufacturers. So representatives of the six biggest pharmaceutical manufacturers got together in Washington with their minions who do this kind of thing and tried to decide if you could improve processes or develop alternative processes, what would be the most important reactions to get better versions of so that you could cut down on this problem of getting rid of chemical waste, especially the hazardous chemical waste. Okay, so this paper, which you could look up if you want to, as I did, has a table in it, and reactions companies now use but would strongly prefer better reagents. So different types of things they're trying to do, the research area, and the number of these six companies, how many of them voted as this is one of their priority areas. So this is an interesting touching with practical world, which we don't do very much in this course. So the one that was unanimously voted was to be able to form amide bonds, avoiding poor atom economy reagents. Now, atom economy means if you have to use an enormous molecular weight, many molecules of something in order to make a single bond, that's not very economic in terms of the mass you're using. You'd rather use something simple. So the very most important thing they said was how to form amides without using lots and lots of bulky reagents, which is what's done now. And we'll talk about that a little later in the next chapter or the next one when we're talking about amides. Okay? But the second, with five votes, was OH activation for nucleophilic substitution. Right? They don't have, you know, we've talked about lots of ways to do that. You protonate it and lose, or you change it into a tosylate or a chloride. But these are not satisfactory from their point of view in terms of what it's the waste that's being generated with the currently available techniques. This doesn't mean that, you know, we might have a group sit around to lunch here sometime and say, gee, what do we want? We all want $1 million. Great. Okay, let's all have $1 million. This doesn't mean you can do it, but it means it's something that's worth people thinking about because it's a big problem in industry. Okay, so that's one criticism people have of some green chemists, is that there's just sort of pie in the sky with nothing concrete about it. I mean, the reason people do it the way they do it now is because it works. And it works more efficiently than other ways that people know of to do it. But it would be neat if there were still better ways, and that's what this guy last week was talking about that I'll mention to you soon. Okay, here's one that's interesting. Reduction of amides without hydride reagents. So we just talked about, amides have carbonyl groups, so you can add H- to the carbon, just as we spoke about, lithium aluminum hydride, sodium borohydride. But those are the very reagents which this report criticizes as being inconvenient. It says, lithium aluminum hydride, having a molecular weight of 38 and 4 hydrides per molecule, has the highest hydride density. So you get 4 hydrides out of this one relatively light molecule. So in terms of that kind of atom economy, that's super. Okay? So it has the highest hydride density and is frequently used, even though it co-generates an inorganic byproduct, the oxidized aluminum, which is difficult to separate from the product. There's slow filtration and product loss through occlusion or adsorption. Those are typical problems. So even though that's very widely used in the pharmaceutical industry, there's a problem with how you actually do the process and get your product out at the end of the day. So that got 4 votes. Another 4 votes came for oxidation and epoxidation methods that don't use chlorinated solvents. We just talked about a reagent that uses a chlorinated solvent. Do you remember what it was for oxidation? Pardon me? It was PCC, pyridinium chlorochromate. Right? The idea was don't use water, use methylene chloride so you can stop at the aldehyde. But they say this is a problem. The use of stoichiometric high-valent metals like manganese, osmium, chromium have virtually been eliminated from pharmaceutical processes because the byproducts are noxious. And especially if any of them remain in the pills, that's really a problem. So to get the Food and Drug Administration to approve your process, you don't want to be using these poisonous metals like osmium. At least don't use them stoichiometrically, 1-to-1. If you can use tiny, tiny amounts as a catalyst, that's one thing. But using mole per mole is bad. Okay, safer and more environmentally friendly Mitsunobu reactions. So I'll tell you in the next slide what a Mitsunobu reaction is. But in fact, this could be considered a subclass of OH activation, as you'll see on the next slide. And then Friedel-Crafts reactions, right? How to do them better. You know, Friedel-Crafts was discovered in 1880, so 130 years ago, or 1885, something like that, so almost 130 years ago. And still, it's a problem of how to do it well. Maybe there is no way to do it really environmentally friendly, right? But then you just have to suck it up. But at least these practical people thought that would be something worth looking for. And the final one is nitrations. Right? And the reason is, remember how you do nitration? What reagent do you use to do a nitration of an aromatic thing? Derek?
H2NO3 and H2SO4.
You use nitric acid and H2SO4. And actually, obviously, large amounts of this are cumbersome to get rid of. Plus, there's a danger with some of these nitration agents that they might be explosive. So these were the top 7 vote-getters among Big Pharma is what they'd like to see improved. Now, the Mitsunobu reaction was one of their top candidates, but I see we're going to have to do that next time. Okay. If you didn't pick up your exam last time, you can get it here.
Will the average be online soon?
Pardon me?
The average.
It is online.
Oh, it's online. Okay.
At least it should be. Has anybody seen it?
Yeah,
it's supposed to be online.
Sorry, I didn't text you.
Okay. I put it on yesterday evening.
Okay. It's online.